Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Monday, March 30th, 2015, and this is show number 516. Well, I gotta say, it is really great to be back. I am exhausted and a bit jet-lagged, but so happy to be home. We had a fantastic trip, and it was such a treat to have three NoCellaCasts to listen to from the guys. I know I thank them in advance, but I think Bart, Guy, Gaz, and Alistair did a great job. I can listen to Bart any day of the week. That's why I listen to all of his podcasts. And it was a treat to get to hear Bryn talking about how he uses his iPad for music work. Even though I don't do any music stuff myself anymore, I did in high school, it was still cool to hear about his progress away from paper. It was especially fun because we got to hang out with Bryn when we were in Ireland with Bart a few years ago, so it was like hearing an old friend. Now, in spite of what Guy said on the show, I really, really enjoyed it. I would like to debate Gaz's perspective on the Apple Watch, and that's what makes this kind of discussion fun. Agreeing with everybody isn't any interesting thing at all, right? I have to admit that I did have that what-was-I-thinking moment after I asked Guy to host the show, but, you know, with Gaz's adult supervision, I was a little bit scarier, actually, after all. All right, closing it out with Alistair was perfect. As I've said many times, Alistair could read me the phone book with that voice and I'd be happy. Man, talk about dulcet tones. I learned a lot from Mike and Lane too, and it really made me think about good and bad training I've had over the years. I bet you guys did too. I was most fascinated when she talked about training the clothing designers on CorelDRAW's vector program and then finding out they really needed Photoshop training and just flipping over to that. You know, that really shows the depth of her knowledge and her talent to be able to change a course on the fly like that. Pretty amazing. I'd love to take a class from her. I hope you enjoyed the shows as much as I did, and I want to just say thank you, thank you, thank you, boys. That was really, really awesome. Well, I want to give you an idea of my trip, but before we went to India, I got to tell you, I was nervous about the country itself, but Steve urged me to put aside my fears and go on a trip of a lifetime, and I'm so glad I did. I'm not going to bore you with Allison's summer vacation, so I thought it might be more fun if I talked about tech as it affected the trip. Well, before going on a trip like this, where we went to three countries, rode on 14 planes, two buses, multiple taxis, and a boat, I really needed to be able to understand the flow to make sure we had the whole thing planned out with no missing pieces. For that, I decided to use OmniGraffle from the Omni Group, which is a super powerful diagramming tool that Bart loves, but with which both Alistair and I have a love-hate relationship. I really feel like that I'm beating it into submission to get it to do my bidding, but in the end, it does do what I need it to do. I should warn you before you get too excited about this tool, OmniGraffle is $99 for the non-pro version. So our trip started in LA. We flew to the United Arab Emirates into the city of Abu Dhabi. Then we took a cab to our first destination, Dubai. After a few days there, we flew to India, starting in Delhi. Two nights in Delhi were followed by a flight to Agra, then Ranthambore, then to Jaipur, then Guwahati, where we got on board the Mahabahu riverboat to sail up the Brahmaputra River. 7 days later, we took three flights that took us through Calcutta and Delhi to finally end up in Nepal, then three more flights to get home to LA. Now do you see why I had to diagram this? Well, I started by making brown boxes for every city, connecting them by arrowed swoopy lines. OmniGraffle lets you put magnets on the boxes, which means if you attach an arrow to a box, you can drag the box all over the place and the arrow is going to kind of follow along. So you don't have to be super precise in your original positioning because you're going to be able to move it later without a lot of difficulty. Now, those magnets are important. I prefer 8 magnets. That puts one on each corner and one in the middle of each side. Now, here's the love-hate thing. I would love to have 8 magnets be the default, but for the life of me, I have not figured out how to make it be to the default. So I have to create a box, tell it to put 8 magnets on it, and then I can duplicate that box. Now, this feature of making it a default could be buried in this somewhere, so if somebody knows how to do it, I would really like to know, but I have never found it on myself. Now, Bart suggested that I create the shapes I like and save them in a stencil file. But I made a bigger mess of it when I tried to do that than it was worth. So what I did was I took my previous trip's diagram, saved it as a stencil, but that made like 28 brown box stencils, 40 arrow lines, you know, I had duplicates of everything in the file. I really need to sit down sometime and grab one of each, put them in one file, and save that as a stencil. We'll see if I have that kind of discipline. I bet I don't. All right, now I've got the cities interconnected with arrows showing the flow, but I couldn't tell the sequence of events. So I added big pink numbers on each line so you could follow the bouncing ball. I do love the way OmniGraffle automatically makes the sequence numbers slide along the line when you drag them, so sort of like a sliding magnet scheme, if that makes any sense. Of course, moving the line itself brings the sequence numbers with it. For plane flights, I put the departure date and time at the beginning of the line and arrival date and time at the end of the line, and then the flight name slash number in the middle of the line. Now, you'll think of this as a giant mess, but to be honest, at first glance, it does look kind of nutty, but if you study it for a bit, it really does work. Again, those beginning and ending times, since I typed them on the line, you can actually slide them along, and if you move the line, all of that information is going to move with it. I have to say that several things worked much better on this trip because of the diagram. First of all, I discovered where we had missing flights. Then our buddy Raleigh, who's listening right now and actually invited us on this crazy trip in the first place, noticed that we were going to be stuck in the Delhi airport for about 15 hours on one flight. So we realized that we needed a hotel for the night because of the diagram. Then when we went through immigration in all three countries, they seemed to want to know what flight and time and city we were going to be visiting for the entire trip. I handed them the diagram, and every one of them acted like, everybody should have one of these, or everybody does have one of these, and I know nobody has one of these. So anyway, it worked really well, and some of the other guys on the trip, Don McAllister and Wally Chirwinski and Raleigh, all decided to try and use the same diagramming tool because it really did help. Now, another planning tool I used was iThoughts from Toquetaware. Yeah, I've talked about it before. It's my favorite mind mapping tool. I love using mind mapping for packing lists. I like it way better than a linear list manager because I don't think of what to pack in a linear way. I might remember the charger for my camera, and the next thing that pops into my head is my toothbrush. Using a mind map, you can just create bubbles for categories of stuff like electronics versus clothes, and then plop bubbles attached to them as you think of them. After a while, I'll realize that I need subcategories, especially under electronics, as you might imagine. I can create a bubble under electronics called cameras and then drag the bubbles that go with that down to that sub-level. I can color code things as I pack them and then collapse a category as the whole thing is all done. I can color code it all in one color and that way I know it's done. The other cool thing is that it works on the Mac, iPad, and iPhone, so whatever device I have in hand when a thought hits me, I can record it and it all syncs via Dropbox. Believe it or not, I did not forget to pack a single thing that I really needed. Since we're on the subject of packing, let's take a rest from the tools to talk about electronics you need slash want for a trip like this. We were traveling with 8 other people, 6 of whom have their geek on in full force. Of course, all Mac people. I should mention that most of us were on at least one Mac Mania cruise together in the past, so that's kind of why we all ended up being Apple geeks. The other guys decided that they would try traveling without their Macs, using only iPads and iPhones. However, they decided to do this only after finding out that Steve would bring his MacBook Air and I would bring my MacBook Pro. I personally can't imagine going without my Mac. By the way, you would not have this show right now if I didn't have my Mac because I typed show notes while I was on my trip. Also, on every trip I take, I write a travelogue, including photos and clever stories about our trip. At least I think they're clever stories. Anyway, I send it out as emails as we travel. While, of course, you could do this on an iPad, it would be a miserable experience. Now, I'm pretty OCD about my photos. I import them into Aperture, I name them, color correct, straighten, and even and keep track of them inside Aperture. I'm good about keeping up with the task throughout the trip, so I'm one of the few people who doesn't come home with a mountain of photos that I will never go through, like most people do. I brought with me the 256GB USB 3 SSD that George from Tulsa gave me and offered to do backups for everyone else. By the way, I had you heard Alistair refer to the SSD, 1 TB SSD that I suggested everybody run out and buy. I think it was $350 through OWC. I had ordered that before I left, but it did not come before I left. So I just had the 256GB drive. However, it became a ritual every day where we would get together in the bar of wherever we were staying, and we had a backup party with gin and tonics. At first, it was really fun, but it got harder and harder to keep track of what was being backed up. Jacques had one camera, shooting only raw photos, so his were the easiest to track because they were all in nice order. That is until he hit the maximum that his Nikon D90 could shoot. I think it was like 9,999 that started over at 1, but at least he didn't have any of the 1, the earliest numbers in his sequence. So every time I got his card, all I had to do was stick it in, find out the last number I'd done, and do everything after that. But Wally had an iPhone 6, a Sanyo video camera, and a GoPro, so his stuff was a nightmare of MP4s, MOVs, JPEGs, all jumbled together. It also didn't help that he had leftover footage from Cirque du Mac in there too, so figuring out the numbering where I'd left off was really, really hard. Shortly, we figured out that the baud rate at which six geeks were taking photos of videos was going to outstrip the 256 gig drive I bought. So Wally and Raleigh had me back up the video to their USB 3 SSDs. Now, you'll notice I said both of their drives, which meant I had to keep track of which drive had which videos and move them back and forth to keep them in sync. Not exactly as easy as I would have liked. More planning on that would be in order next time, along with agreed-upon naming conventions. I think I remember at one point having Wally Sanyo Part 2. It got really confusing, but everything did get backed up. Don McAllister brought a really interesting tool. He brought a drive called the Western Digital My Passport Wireless. This is a cool device that lets you stick in an SD card, and it automatically backs it up, all without a computer. It did work well, but it was impossible to verify that it was actually doing the job because there's no display. We used my Mac to verify it from time to time because it would sometimes lose power in the middle of a backup or take so long that we were sure it had failed. It's a good idea, but I sure wouldn't erase my memory cards if I were using that device before getting home. Don said that he would not travel on a trip like this again with just an iPad. He has his eye on the new MacBook, 12-inch MacBook for future trips. We had some good swapping going on of hardware on the trip. Wendy bought the Olympus EM10 camera that I recommended, so when I ran out of battery power, she loaned me a battery. Wally had the same model GoPro as Steve, so when Steve misplaced his third battery one afternoon, Wally was able to rescue him. Jacques brought only one 16-gigabyte memory card for his Nikon D90, and since he kept it on rapid fire even if he was taking photos of a flower, he quickly filled that up. So I was able to give him one of my spare 32-gig SD cards. Wally and Wendy hadn't brought an Indian power adapter, but luckily Steve packed a spare, so we were able to save them. It was nice we were all able to help each other like that, so my advice is only go on vacation with other geeks. Steve also brought a really cool power strip. It has a US-style plug for the wall, but then four universal power ports on the power strip. It comes with wall adapters for a slew of countries, so with just one adapter for each country style, he could plug the power strip into the wall and charge four devices. It was only around $25 on Amazon and even includes a surge protector, so it was the best accessory we could have brought. One morning, though, this company sent the wrong adapters on the first shipment, so he had to send the whole thing back. So be sure to check it before you go on your trip. If you have international travelers coming to see you often, this would be a great thing to put in the guest room, too. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. I wanted to talk about some of the difficulties we had with tech. In the U.S., you take your computer out of your bag, but nothing else when you go through security. In India and Nepal, you pretty much have to take everything out. In Delhi, I had to go through the screener about four times, taking out computers, iPads, iPhones, hard drive, cable, cameras, and even separate lenses. I was always the last one through the line. By the way, they scan the humans in two different lines, girls and boys separated. The men are frisked publicly, but the women get the pat down in a little curtain booth. Oh, get this, you get to bring water through security, which was really swell. A week of our trip was on a fabulous riverboat called the MV Mahabahu that traveled up the Brahmaputra River. The river was spectacular. The food was crazy good. We never ate the same thing twice. The naturalist was amazing and the service was at your beck and call. Surprisingly, they had Wi-Fi on the boat. We hadn't thought there was going to be Wi-Fi, but they did have it, but it was really, really bad. We actually saw sub 1 kilobyte per second speeds. I think the fastest I ever saw was 14 kilobytes per second. Woo! It was amazing. Now, remember I said at the beginning how I send out an email every day of the trip? Well, I had to get my emails under 1 megabyte with photos, let it run all night long to have any hope of it getting through. Sometimes it took me multiple days to get one out. I know some of you are thinking I shouldn't worry about tech on a trip, but I really like writing my letters and sending photos back home, and people seem to really enjoy them. I don't stop doing the fun stuff at all. I go on every excursion, and I don't miss a thing. I just do dedicate some time to getting it done. On the last day of the riverboat trip, a lot of people said I sent the message out two or three times. Linda said that. Anyway, I definitely only sent it out once. So something about the dodgy internet might have caused that. Here's another fun fact to know and tell. When you have really slow speeds, the message remains in the outbox long after it's been received at the other end. The way I address the message is I make the message to Steve with everyone else on blind CC so I know when it gets through. However, if you delete it from the outbox, so if it had already gotten to Steve, but I delete it from the outbox, it never shows up in my sent mail. How's that for weird? Steve thinks maybe what's going on is that the photos haven't all gone through, because sometimes when it was still in my outbox, but it had showed up in his, he didn't have the images yet. I'm not really sure if that's true, but it's a good supposition. Another side effect of not having internet on the boat most of the time was that to give each other photos, if I'd taken a picture of Jacques or something, I wanted to give it to him, we had to use AirDrop. That should work great, right? But what none of us realized was that without the internet, AirDrop is really, really slow. I have no technical explanation for that, but most of the time we had trouble even finding one another on AirDrop. For example, Wally had an iPhone 6 Plus and an iPhone 5S. Only the 5S would show up on AirDrop. One day, nobody could see my iPhone at all, but the next day it would work fine. AirDrop is supposed to rely on Bluetooth, so why did the lack of internet make it so hard to use? Now, Brett in the live chat is saying that AirDrop does use Wi-Fi, so I'm still confused about that, because I know that we didn't have Wi-Fi sometimes and we were able to do AirDrop. So maybe it does like ad hoc Wi-Fi, but really slow unless you're on real Wi-Fi, which makes no sense, because it should be faster to go point to point than to go up to the internet and turn around and come back. So I'm not really sure how this thing works. There were cases where if we had our VPN on, we couldn't AirDrop to each other, which would sort of imply that it does use Wi-Fi. So that, I'm getting really confused here. So let's talk about the VPN, because that's a whole category of stuff that it got really interesting. When we were on the boat, we didn't bother with a VPN since we knew everybody on board, and because the bandwidth was so bad, there's no way we could have gotten up to a server and back down. But when we did use a VPN, we noticed a lot of interesting side effects. So Steve takes a lot of our photos with his GoPro. It's kind of funny. It's made for video, but it is the best selfie camera because it's so wide angle. You can get yourself and whatever else you're trying to show to people in the background without even having to look at it. It's way better than using an iPhone, in my opinion. But I needed a way to transfer his photos from him to me, but we had the VPN on when we had Wi-Fi, so we couldn't do it. Like, he couldn't text message it to me and we couldn't AirDrop. It didn't work. Our solution was for me to create an ad hoc network, and then he could be able to connect to it from his computer. With file sharing turned on, I could log into his machine and drag the files over. Easy enough, but the bad news is there's zero security on the ad hoc network when it's open. Now, Apple used to have cruddy security with web encryption, at least, and I know that's really easy to crack, but at least it was something. Somewhere along the line, they got rid of even that. So I'd create the network, we'd hold our breath for the few seconds it took us to connect Steve and move the files over and then shut it off as fast as we could. It was scary, but I think we survived it. All right, while I've been yapping here, Steve in the live chat room has dropped in some information that he found on iPad.about.com that explains how Bluetooth or how AirDrop works. And it is a combination of what we've been saying. AirDrop uses Bluetooth to create a peer-to-peer Wi-Fi network between the devices. Each device creates a firewall around the connection, and files are sent encrypted, which actually makes it safer than transferring via email. Now, that does still raise some questions about why it's so slow when we didn't have real Wi-Fi, but at least that gives us a little bit more information about that. So thanks, Steve, for sending that to me. All right, let's get back to the VPN. When we were stuck in Delhi for the 15-hour layover at a transit hotel, Steve wanted to watch the World Cricket semifinals between India and Australia. Oddly, the hotel had a giant monitor in the room hooked up to a DVD player, but it wasn't a TV. He started watching on his laptop instead. After a while, I reminded him to make sure he had his cloak VPN turned on, so he switched it on. Within a few seconds, he was greeted with a window explaining that since he's not in India, he can't watch cricket for free. He'd have to go to the paid service. Since Cloak didn't have a VPN server in India, he was out of luck. We decided that as long as he didn't log into anything important, he'd pick cricket over security. So he turned off the Cloak VPN, and he was able to watch it, the cricket match again, because we were in India. All right. As you know, I'm a huge fan of CrashPlan for my automated offsite backups. However, with these dodgy internet connections, it wasn't practical to let them run. As far as I know, there's no way to tell CrashPlan to simply stop until I tell it to start back up again. I'm going to just go, okay, take a rest, CrashPlan, take a chill pill, just don't do anything. I'll tell you when you can start backing me up again. I couldn't do that. But the good news is that when you join a new network, you can tell it to not back up on that particular network. But we're on 9 separate networks in 3.5 weeks, and it was hard to remember to shut it off. I'm sure I was sucking precious kilobytes on the boat when we first got there with CrashPlan trying to run backups. The good news is that I did remember to turn off PhotoStream on all my devices right when I left. That's the one thing I usually forget when I go and travel, and I burn through data like there's no tomorrow, so I was really proud of myself for remembering this time. You can imagine how much data I would have used with over 1,700 photos going from my camera to my Mac up to my iPhone and back to my iPad. I do burn through a lot of data. Another tech problem on our trip was how many hotels had a 3-device limit. Steve and I both had our Macs and our iPhones, and I had my iPad, so 5 devices seemed like a reasonable limit to us. Instead, we had to take turns on who had to let their iPhone be online. It's a nightmare, I tell you. It was a horrible trip. Well, one day, I think in Nepal it was, we had to sacrifice both iPhones because Steve had run out of books on his Kindle, so we had to use up a slot to get him something to read for the long journey home. I did try to figure out if I could buy from Amazon from my Mac and somehow use Calibre to move it to the Kindle, but I figured DRM would probably stop me from doing what I wanted to do. Well, other than that, everything tech-wise was flawless. When Steve and I normally travel, we meet interesting people everywhere we go. There's little opportunity for that, though, when you travel in a large group because you've got no motivation. You already have friends to talk to. But one night, Steve and I got to the hotel bar in Jaipur ahead of our group, and a man hollered out, "We saw you in Ranthambore!" It turned out they'd been to the same hotel when we went on our first Jeep safari to see tigers. We walked over to them, and then one of them noticed Steve was wearing an Apple shirt and breathlessly asked, "Do you work for Apple?" Well, that was enough to bond the four of us for life. I really wish I could remember these guys' names because they were delightful. One of them showed me an awesome app for iOS called TouchNote. Here's the problem to be solved. When you're on travel, it's fun to send postcards home, but it's a giant pain to A, find postcards, B, find the right denomination stamp, and C, find a postal box. Our buddy Ron always sends us a postcard on travel. I have no idea how he pulls this off. Enter the free TouchNote app for iOS from touchnote.com. The way it works is you buy credits in the app, and I bought 6 credits for like $10, I think, which was the smallest denomination. I was able to send postcards to the U.S. for the equivalent of $1.33 each, which is really pretty inexpensive. I know TouchNote isn't the first company to do this, but they do it beautifully. You give TouchNote access to your photo library, then pick out a layout for the card. You can add a caption to the photo side, and then you write your brilliant and witty text on the other side. The good news is you can send multiple copies of the same postcard to different people, so I wasn't forced to create multiple postcards. The bad news is that the app does not ask for permission to have access to your address book, so you have to type in the addresses by hand. I wish I would just use the address book, but I suffered through. I put a screenshot in the show notes of what it looked like on my end. I didn't send a copy to myself, but my friend Diane told me that the finished product had arrived and that the cardstock was shiny and thick, the images were crisp and beautiful, and that the text was clear and readable. It arrived in 4 days, which is inside of what they promised at TouchNote. The cool thing is that the postcard did not have to travel all the way from Nepal to the U.S. I think they're a British company, but they must have had it printed and mailed from the U.S. to get it there quite that fast. Diane confirmed that the postmark was from Arizona, which is not quite as cool as if it had said Nepal, but she probably got it 2 weeks earlier than she would have if it had come from Nepal. I also, this is kind of funny, we are doing the show live, of course, and I just got an email from my mother-in-law who said that the postcard was beautiful enough to frame. I give TouchNote a big thumbs up and will keep using it for sure. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. I have a few other random travel tech tidbits to share with you. When we finally did get on real internet in Calcutta, that was interesting too. We tried on our iOS devices to get into the internet at the hotel, but the screen would not render properly for us to log in. They had to send the IT guy to help us. He typed in a lengthy URL with some .jsp stuff at the end, and we were in. Getting real internet after a week of 14 kilobytes per second on the ship when we were lucky was like drinking from a cool, clean fountain after a hike through the desert. We were so excited when we met at the hotel bar and we had internet. I distinctly remember Jacques looking at me with glee in his eye and saying, "I updated an app!" And he gave me a white man's high five. It was awesome. It was sad for the two of us who were not into geek stuff, but it was pure joy for the normal people in the group. Like I said, 8 out of 10 of us were geeks. I should mention that when we did get internet, I had 38 app updates waiting on my phone, plus iOS 8.2. Steve urged me to wait for the iOS update just to be safe till I got home. Now, normally I have automatic app updates running, so it was interesting to see how many really come in when you're not paying attention. I mean, that's more than one a day. I never did let my Mac run software updates because half-good internet made it nuts. I kept asking for my password in the middle of the app updates, but then rejecting it as too slow, so I finally gave up. I have never been in so many places where the power goes out so frequently. Just about every hotel we went to had at least one short-term power outage while we were there. It happened at the tea plantation. It even happened in the Delhi airport. It always resumed in a minute or two, so it wasn't a huge problem, but it was endemic in Nepal and India. I don't remember it happening in the UAE, but that's a very wealthy country with all brand new infrastructure. Speaking of infrastructure, the wiring in India and Nepal was absolutely nuts. I put an image in the show notes of a typical street corner. I forget if that one's in India or Nepal, but it was all alike. It basically looks like hundreds and hundreds of wires just all jumbled up on a ball and dragging across multiple buildings. Every time I looked at it, I would say, "Ever heard of crosstalk?" To which Raleigh would respond, "Ever heard of talk? How does anything get through there?" One of our guides told us that it's phone, TV, and power. And it, as Raleigh said, it looked like anybody who wants a phone line or power or TV just strung a new line every single time they wanted to do it. So let's see. Probably the most humorous tech problem happened in Ranthambore, which is where we went on the game safari and saw a tiger. The hotel was idyllic. It was set in a jungle, had a little bungalow spread around a beautiful garden, a fantastic pool. The jungle was right, you know, the tigers were right nearby. It was really, really cool. They explained, though, that there was internet in the lobby and a little bit of internet on the veranda, but that it didn't reach out to the rooms. Of course, that meant we all kept huddling in the lobby to sip some internet. It was pretty poor. One day, Steve and I were sitting there, and of course, the power went out. When it came back up, we had no internet at all. So Steve asked the front desk if perhaps they could reboot the wireless router. The guy smiled and said, "Of course," and then walked into the lobby and reached down to the router, which they had placed behind the metal fireplace screen. Now, if you don't catch why that's so funny, it turns out that the absolute best way to block electromagnetic signals is to erect a mesh of a conductive material around the transmitter. I believe it was Michael Faraday who first discovered this phenomena, so it's referred to as a Faraday cage. We tried to explain to them that they might have a wee bit more success with their internet service if they put the wireless router on the mantle instead of behind the metal fireplace screen. They smiled and agreed, but I'll bet dollars to donuts that the next shift put it right back where it belonged. One thing that helped us not miss the family too much in almost a full month of travel was using FaceTime where we had good internet. We were in Dubai when Steve's dad's 80th birthday occurred, so we prearranged a time with Steve's mom to make sure she had her iPad ready. It was so awesome to be able to see and talk to him literally on the other side of the world. Later, Lindsay or Kyle, I forget which, told us that when they called him, he said, "Steve and Allison Facebooked me." Oh, well, he got close. We did post a screenshot of us and him on Facebook, so I guess that's close enough. We also FaceTimed with Kyle, which was a bit easier because he was working nights, so daylight for us was when he was awake. He's really goofy. I think you'll like the screenshot I put in the show notes. He was showing us the moon. That's what he's pointing at. Lindsay had the advantage, though. She's watching Tesla for us, so we got to see her on FaceTime. I have to admit, though, that the dog did not seem a bit interested in the whole time FaceTime experience. I've talked about TimeScroller often over the years, and it was really invaluable during this trip. When we first arrived in Dubai, TimeScroller told us that we were 12 hours ahead of our home in Los Angeles. But while we were there, the U.S. went on to, or is it off of, daylight saving time, so then we were 13 hours ahead of home. All right, that's fine. But then we went to India. India decided something brilliant a while ago. They didn't want to have this whole mess, so they decided to be all in the same time zone. The problem was that the country didn't sit geographically where you'd expect one whole hour to be, so they moved it by a half hour. So now we were 13 and a half hours ahead of home. Well, that was pretty good for time in India, but the crazy Nepalese were off by another 15 minutes. So now we were off by 13 hours and 45 minutes. If you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you know that the real math like calculus came really easy to me, but I have a lot of trouble with arithmetic. So just picture it's 8:13 in the evening, and I've got to add 13 hours and 45 minutes to that. Not happening. Time scroller for the win. Well, I have a pretty good sense about what time it is in Europe because I chat with Bart so often, but it was a mystery to me on the trip, and time scroller saved me again. New Zealand is a real challenge since they're A, living in the future by nearly a day, and B, are south of the equator. So when we go into summer, they go into winter, which means when they go into daylight saving time, we're moving out. That means they actually get farther away in time from us. Throw that 45-minute offset into the mix, and I had no chance of knowing what time it was when I wanted to chat with Alistair or Devin or Marianne. Time Scroller on iOS and the Mac as a widget was my constant tool of choice. When the Big Apple announcement occurred at 10 a.m. in California time, we had just gotten to Delhi, India, so that meant the show was on at 10:30 p.m. our time. Don, Wally, and I sat up, and Steve sat up in our room with two MacBooks and Don's iPad to watch the news. It was a real slog staying up that late after a long day traveling from Dubai, but we knew we just had to do it. We'd never forgive ourselves if we didn't see it. It was good we had three devices working on it because even though we had acceptable internet, it was just like at home where one device would lose the show so we'd flip over to the next. It's a fun memory of the trip with the four of us huddled around a 9.7-inch iPad in the end. Here's one fun bit. While we were watching across the globe, Bart tipped me off that he and Stephen Getz and Switcher Mark were in the NoSilicast chat room while watching, so we were able to actually chat while we watched the show. It was kind of surreal to be doing something so normal, but in such an extraordinary place. Oh, another fun tidbit. When we first arrived, I got an email from NoSilicast listener Navin Kilnani welcoming us to Delhi. I just wish I'd known sooner that we'd be in his hometown so we could have had a meetup, but it was too late to set something up. I did want to give Navin a shout-out, though. Well, Stephen and I chose to use our American Express card to pay for things on the trip because they don't charge you to use it internationally. Both MasterCard and Visa charge, I think, 1% as a foreign transaction fee, but Amex does not. On the trip, Steve discovered another huge advantage of Amex, and that's the tech angle. That's that they send an email to him instantly every time we use it. Instantly if we had internet, of course. Seriously, we'd order a gin and tonic in the hotel bar before we were half done drinking it, the email would come through. Now that's going to round out my travel documentary about how tech was impacted on such a crazy journey. I guess I should mention that we also saw goats, monkeys, donkeys, water buffalo, cows, dogs, goats, camels, camels carrying baby goats, peacocks, warthogs, geese, rhinos, elephants, and two tigers. I have to admit something. Before I left, I was able to come up with three new examples of how I use Clarify to send to the boys for inclusion as ads in the shows. But in the last 4 weeks, I didn't do a single tutorial for anyone. Maybe it was the lack of internet. Maybe it was how much fun I was having eating and drinking, watching rhinos and tigers. Maybe it was how relaxed and pampered I was. I didn't do anything to help anybody else with their computers or iOS devices. I think this may be the first time I've gone that long without using Clarify. I'm certain that if it weren't for Clarify, I wouldn't do nearly as much to help others. I love it, by the way, when I hear from you how you've used Clarify to take screenshots, annotate them, and post your tutorials to clarify-it.com so you have to only answer a question once. I want you to keep those stories coming because I really, really like them. If you don't know what we're talking about, go over to clarify-it.com and give Clarify a free trial. They have Mac or Windows or both if you're a slider versions to, if you're a slider likes to help others, you'd really, really like this tool. And be sure to tell them Allison sent you. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchotz. The band's back together, Bart.
Yay. It's nice to hear your voice. It was fun. It was fun having Bren on for chit-chatting, but it's nice to be back talking to you.
Yeah, I missed you. And I was glad that we pushed this out by a day because you suggested that perhaps in my unconscious state I would not be able to do a Taming the Terminal.
I thought jet lag and SSH mightn't be the best mix.
And that's one of the ones I'm looking forward to because I have never been able to crack the code on that.
Oh, good. Good. Then so, we have lots of fun to look forward to, but it's been a busy 2 weeks security-wise. Believe it or not, when you look at the show notes, this is just 2 weeks worth of news because I did a special security light for
and that was full. Yeah, that was packed.
Yeah, and that was 1 week. So, I don't know what's going on. The world is obviously going to hell in a handcart or something.
I guess so. You know, I wrote to Tom Merritt and I said, hey, I'm back. Can you do a show for me that just tells me what happened while I was gone? He said, yeah. He said, yeah, it'll be 20 hours, though.
Oh, dear.
All right.
Well, actually, we have a security medium to start with.
Those are the ones we can't do anything about, right? But we should know.
No, it's no. You can do something about this one as not set your hair on fire. But there were four stories that just were too related to have as four separate stories, and I thought we should have one sane discussion instead of four piecemeal discussions.
Okay.
So basically, it all revolves around a bad couple of weeks for HTTPS/TLS. So we all know that the public key infrastructure, or the PKI, is what gives us the little HTTPS in our browsers, and it secures our email clients, and it secures our chat clients, and it secures pretty much everything that gets secured. And there's been a couple of news stories. There's been four news stories, in fact, that fall into two categories. The first two sound very scary, but don't panic, right? So I'm going to say that now. Okay. There is no need to put your hair on fire. So two different weaknesses have been found in the same cryptographic cipher. This is ORC4, is the name of the cipher. And it's in use by about a third of all HTTPS connections at the moment. And these are theoretical vulnerabilities, and they work in a lab where you can literally throw millions or billions of packets at it and stuff like that.
Okay.
They're not practical in the real world. So what this is a wake-up call to the community that it's time to move on from ORC4. Attacks only get better. So the fact that this is now possible in a lab but not in the real world is one step away from this is going to happen in the real world. So if you're running a website, it's time to have a look at your configuration, disable ORC4, and then just carry on. And if you're a regular user, just keep your browser up to date and don't worry about it.
Oh, okay.
Because it's a very scary sounding story. I believe Ars Technica headlined it, "Noose Around Internet System Titans," which sounds scary, so I thought we should defuse that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good that they're doing this in the lab so that people know it's time to step up the game, right?
Exactly. You know, this is good. This is security at work, right? These are two different papers presented at two different security conferences by two different groups of researchers. It's all good research. This is very important stuff. But we don't have to panic as end users. Okay. So the next two problems are all to do with people issuing certs that aren't supposed to get issued. And in one case, it's the certificate authority's fault. And in one case, it isn't. So the first story that made all the big headlines was when Microsoft had to release an update to revoke a whole bunch of certs on Microsoft sites, which were improperly issued certs. And Microsoft kind of made it sound like the certificate authority boobed, but that's not actually true.
Oh.
Where Microsoft messed up is in how something called domain control validation works. So if you go to buy a certificate for podfeet.com, you have to prove that you own podfeet.com or no one will issue you a cert. And the way you prove that is to demonstrate domain control, i.e. domain control validation, DCV. And a couple of ways you can do that. They can make you set a random DNS record. So they choose a giant big random number and say, now make that a DNS record on your domain. If you can do that, then you control the domain. They might make you put an arbitrary URL that they randomly generated. Or the most common thing is to use email-based domain control validation. So there's a list of email addresses at a domain that are considered admin email addresses. And if you can receive an email at that address and give them back the code they emailed you, they'll issue you a cert. And one of those addresses is hostmaster@your domain. So Microsoft give out email to the public. So you can be Allison@live.com or live.fi or live.be or live.ie. And they didn't actually protect Hostmaster. So anyone could go in and set Hostmaster as an alias to their live account and then issue certificates for Microsoft domains.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And what's worse is a Finnish guy discovered this years ago, has been trying to tell Microsoft for years, and eventually made them listen by just going ahead and doing it. It was the only way he could get a response out of Microsoft was to register the cert and, I guess, send it to them.
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
No, I'm deadly serious. And then, of course, Microsoft, oh, panic, 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 panic. And I was like, oh, for God's sake. So anyway, so Microsoft boobed on that one. Then the second one is definitely the certificate authority's fault. There were a bunch of certificates showed up. You know the way, well, I think we've mentioned this before, but Google Chrome is very picky about SSL certificates for Google-owned products or for Google-owned websites. Because, of course, Google make Chrome and Google run their own website. So Google can actually program into Chrome the serial numbers of valid Google certs. And if Chrome is handed a cert for a Google-owned property that doesn't match the serial number programmed into it, it knows something is afoot in the wind, as it were. And it phones home and it tells Google what the shirt was that was handed to it that was not correct. And this is how we discovered that there were a whole bunch of fraudulent certs doing the round, and they were traced back to a single certificate authority in China. The Chinese Internet Network Information Center is the name of the certificate authority in question. And what they had done is they had issued a certificate with the power to sign certificates to an Egyptian company who they made promise they wouldn't abuse it. Who promptly went and abused it. Yeah. So okay. Then we got a whole bunch of browser updates to remove those certificates. So what end users need to know here is that browser updates matter, because that's how we're protected from all of these boobs. They just keep on updating our browser with a new set of certificates to ignore. Now, actually, the real problem the industry have to fix is that the revocation system does not work well. So that's what the tech guys have to figure out, a proper way to do good, secure revocation. But for us, the end user, just keep your browser up to date and don't put your hair on fire.
Okay. Even for the Microsoft problem?
Yes, because what's happened is we've all had updates to our browsers where those certificates have been... So Microsoft have now closed that hole, so they have now stopped people using that address. And now we all have browser updates that revoke those certificates.
Okay.
So, by the way, all is well again with the world.
By the way, I asked this on the side, but we never actually talked about it on the show. You and Dorothy together created a tutorial to show us how to create a Chrome-safe browser back when there was a problem, but we don't need to use that anymore, right?
That is correct. That was to do with one of the many SSL hacks there have been in the last while.
Okay, because I still have Chrome safe and I keep forgetting to delete it. But
Google were going to, it was in their path for their next version to be released a month after Dorothy created that thing. So a month after is well in the past now, so you should be fine.
Okie dokie, good.
Okay, so that's our medium end of the way. So now we can get into the actual security light. In terms of updates, it seems to be just Apple who are at it. Security update 2015-003 for older versions of OS 10 and OS 10.10.2 all fix a number of security bugs. Probably the most noteworthy one is a problem with iCloud Keychain that got patched. That sounds like it's worth fixing. And there was also an update for Safari from Apple. So that again sounds like it's worth fixing.
How far back did they patch? How old?
10.5, I don't know.
I mean, it wasn't... Was it?
Okay, so 10.5.3. Let's see what it says. Yeah, okay, go. Apple don't seem to say.
Okay.
Useful.
I was just curious whether anything had changed and how far back they went.
Maybe I'm not reading this page very well, but I can't see a list of OSs it applies to, which is actually very silly. No, it's not on the Apple page.
Okie dokie.
Okay, into important security news, and this is sort of the big section. Over the past couple of years, we've been watching an ongoing saga of... Do you remember that Apple had a button in Safari that was supposed to disable third-party cookies, and someone found a way to trick Safari into accepting the third-party cookie anyway, and Google decided that meant it was okay to stick third-party cookies despite the user's explicit expression of their intent not to have them tracked. In the US, they got a slap on the wrist, and that was kind of the end of the story. In the UK, that was still trickling its way through the courts, and a UK judge has now ruled that every citizen of the United Kingdom is free to sue Google over this.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. So that hopefully will make them think twice about... basically thinking they're above the law. It's just, it made me very cranky at the time, so I kind of like this outcome.
Good, good. I do remember that.
Just to underline the fact that Tinder, which is a, we'll call it a dating
call
app.
Call it dating.
We'll call it dating. It's dating.
It's targeted toward, it's for gay men, right? Or gay people?
No. Tinder is the straight version of the other one. I can't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Tinder is the one for, Tinder came along after the one I can't think of the name of, sort of the straight version of it. And what's actually quite funny is, so there's been a lot of talk about the fact that their API is not particularly secure. So to prove the point, a guy set up an app that tricks men into chatting each other up, only they're straight men. So they each think they're talking to a pretty girl, but they've actually had their conversations connected to each other, and apparently hilarity ensues.
Oh, good, good.
So... basically, the
that'll
point
make
of
your customers
site.
Happy,
right? So the point of the site is to make Tinder fix their API, and it seemed that humor was the best way to achieve that aim. So, There we go. Somewhat bad news, and I really don't know what people should do about this because it's so hard to keep Android up to date, but about half of Android phones have a vulnerability where you can... So you know the way when you install an app, it tells you what the app is looking for permission for. So I want permission to access the network. I want permission to access the keychain.
Camera,
I want permission.
Your location. Yeah.
Yeah, all of those things.
Right.
It is possible in half of the Android phones out there today to present one app, get the user to click OK, and substitute it with another app between them clicking OK and it being installed. So you can present someone a completely innocent app and then install a malicious app with different permissions, and the installer will take the permissions from the second. So you can put up a game that says, I want no permissions, and install an app that takes all permissions.
Oh, you're kidding. No.
No, not.
So what is causing the exploit? The first app?
It's to do... You have to get the person to go to the app through a website. You have to sort of set it up a little bit.
Okay.
But it's not particularly, you know, it takes a little bit of finagling on the bad guy side, but it's not difficult.
Not hard, as hard as it should be, right?
Right. So it's patched in a recent version of Android, but the problem is, can everyone's handset take the most recent version of Android? When will it arrive? You know, when as it goes through the handset manufacturer and then your cell phone provider. So I really don't know what advice to give Android users other than the fact that I just wouldn't use Android.
I think it's certainly not fail-safe, but you're less vulnerable if you stick to the store. That isn't saying this won't happen in the store, but going to your website to sideload, because you have to actively say to allow your phone to sideload. I believe now it switches back to not letting you sideload. Like, it doesn't stay in always let me sideload mode, I believe.
So if you do an update, it flips back, and then you have to reassert your desire.
Well, not even an update. I think it flips back within a single version. I think it keeps defaulting back to not sideload, I believe, in the later versions. So that's good. But that doesn't mean this won't sneak in.
Right. And it also doesn't really resolve the problem of when there's a security problem, Google can't get it out to people quick enough because you have this really convoluted route between them and you.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
It makes you very uncomfortable.
If you have unsophisticated friends, do not show them how to sideload. Don't teach them.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Also, this is to warn people who use Steam, which is a very popular cross-platform gaming platform. Mm-hmm. So it's like an app store for games that exists on the PC and the Mac, and I think there might even be a Linux version, actually. Mm-hmm. They have this thing called Greenlight Projects, which are sort of a place where you can preview up-and-coming stuff, and someone found a way to sneak some malware into that briefly. So I think basically what it showed is that the green light pages weren't being as well secured as they should have been by Steam. So just be a little careful on Steam. Hopefully Steam have learned a lesson and that won't happen again. But they were distributing malware for a while, which is not good. We talked, I think, I can't remember when I talked about it, but at some stage before or after you left for India, we talked about the fact that Oracle have started to ship adware into Java.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was the last time you and I talked, because I remember you, the top of your head blowing off that you were done with Java.
Right, and I'm done with Java from Oracle. So there are open source versions of Java for Linux. So if I'm going to use Java, it's going to be on Linux. You've been using OpenJDK or something like that. But basically, Intego have done a deep dive on exactly what the installer does and exactly what it installs and exactly what's going on. And so if you are running Java and you want to know exactly what the story is, there's a link in the show notes here to a great article from Intego that explains that actually, even when they don't activate the toolbar, they always install it. So they can activate it later at any time.
Oh, so it's more icky than before.
It's even more icky than I thought it was, yeah.
Jeez.
So I'm really done with it. I never liked Oracle and I utterly detest them now. Mm. Also, on the detestable level, while you were away, there was a leak in an American newspaper. I think it was one of the Times. It was probably the New York Times, but I don't know for sure, so I'm not going to say. Where basically the FTC had done an investigation of Google. That investigation found that Google was intentionally skewing its results to harm its competitors, and they didn't act on it. They just sat on it.
Wait, the FTC didn't act on it, or Google didn't act on it?
FTC didn't act. It's still sitting. So to me, this is a giant scandal, but in the mainstream media, no one seems to care. So basically, they have found this, there is a report, and there is no action been taken. So who regulates the regulators? Anyway.
My tax dollars at work.
Indeed. And just in case I haven't made the point enough today, update your browsers. So Pwn2Own was last week. All the major browsers got hacked. There are updates to all of them. So patch. One I thought was interesting. So some scientists put some people into an MRI machine, which is always a good start to a sentence. And they discovered that if you show people as little as two security warnings in quick succession, their brains actually shut down.
That's awesome.
It's awesome. It explains so much about the world. So I thought we'd want to know that.
Oh, that's good.
I also thought we should talk about a really interesting hardware hack you may or may not have picked
up. Wait, Bart, does that mean nobody has ever heard the second thing you've said in Security Light? It might be just you and me talking. Nobody else is paying any attention.
Maybe, but oh, dear.
I think okay, keep going. I'm enjoying it.
So while you were away, this hardware thing came out. Have you seen this? It's a physical device for hacking iPhones.
No, I didn't see that.
So the idea is, you have to take the iPhone apart to do this, right? It's a very clever hack. So it only works if you have a PIN code in your iPhone, not if you have a complex password. But most people have PINs. Mm-hmm. And in theory, after 9 tries, the phone is meant to shut down.
Right.
And stop you trying anymore. These guys found a way around that. There is like a 5-millisecond gap between failing the PIN and the actual failure being recorded onto the hardware.
Oh, really?
And so they rigged it up in such a way that when it fails, it instantly kills the power quicker than the phone can record the failure. And therefore, it can keep trying infinitely long because the failure isn't being recorded. But of course, to do this, you have to physically open the iPhone and connect onto the motherboard, right?
Oh, okay.
So it's a fairly invasive process. But if there's enough information on the phone, it's valuable enough. And the good news is, if you've upgraded to the latest version of iOS, this doesn't work anymore.
Oh, good.
Because Apple changed how they do the failure. So it used to be the case that you would fail. It would then write the fact that you failed into the little piece of the piece of hardware memory.
Mm-hmm.
What they do now is they assume you're going to fail. They write the failure. Then they see how you did. And if you got it right, they remove the failure.
Oh, that's clever.
Therefore, this hack is now useless. It can't work anymore. Because there is no gap.
Wow.
So, very clever solution, and we're all fixed. Of course, the device made the news, the fix didn't, which is why I thought it was important.
Of course it did.
You know how these things go.
There you go.
And just one final thing that popped into my feed, literally just minutes before we recorded. Brian Krebs at Krebs on Security is warning Americans that if they haven't signed themselves up at irs.gov, they should do so because there's a lot of fraud going on where people are signing up as other people and filing fraudulent tax returns. If you basically what he says is sign up at irs.gov before someone does it for you.
Wow. That's so fun.
Yeah. Oh, I forgot about the notable breaches bit. Uber logins are showing up for sale on the dark web, which means that Uber logins have been hacked. That's probably not a good thing because I imagine that means there's people driving around cars on other people's dime.
Hmm.
Uber have also decided to join the people who sell big data. So they're now selling people's movements and shopping habits to people who pay for it, which is a little worrying. Radio Shack, in their bankruptcy mess, have decided that their privacy policy doesn't apply to them anymore. So their privacy policy says we will never sell your information. They're now selling customer information for profit to try, break even on the bankruptcy. So I thought that was particularly slimy. The Oakland Police Department are just giving away the data from the license plate reader. If you don't know why that should concern you, have a read of the article linked in the show notes.
Hmm.
I don't know what Twitch is, but apparently it's a big deal.
Twitch is a gaming platform. It's where you sit and watch other people play video games. That's what Justin.TV, when they bumped us off of Justin, they moved everything over to Twitch. And if you weren't a gamer, you didn't get to have an account anymore.
Oh.
That's why we're not on Justin anymore.
Yeah. Well, in that case, maybe it's karma. Basically, they had a big breach. They've had to reset everyone's password.
Mm.
In a surprisingly amateurish blunder, Hilton Honors basically boobed completely on security. So if you have a Hilton Honors account, I would very strongly recommend you log in, make sure no one's pinched your points, and change your password. And finally, I don't know how big a deal this is because I don't live in the US, but Perma Blue Shield had a bit of a leak and 11 million customers' data may have been lost. Which jibes nicely with... So all of those people who had health insurance, not with the last crowd who boobed, who were they again?
If you got me, that was Anthem Blue Cross.
Anthem Blue Cross, and this is Perma Blue Shield. What is it with the color blue?
I don't know. Well, you don't want red.
Yes, you do. The Red Cross are great.
There you go. Well, maybe you shouldn't be with these blue ones.
Oh, dear. There's also a suggested rating, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Just some sort of ones to particularly point you at. There's a very good parent's guide to in-app purchase on the Intego blog. So if you have people who aren't sure what it means, they have an iPhone, they have kids, it might be a good read. There was also a whole bunch of FUD doing the rounds when Apple went USB-C for the MacBooks. People saying, oh, bad USB will ruin your chargers. Rich Mogul talks sense to people. That's over on Tidbits. If you're worried, have a read. There's also a giant big hoopla about Microsoft Secure Boot. There's a link in the show notes if you care.
Actually, that was a little bit interesting. I think it's called Microsoft Hello. And on the SMR podcast, Chris Ashley was quoting from Paul Thurrott, quoting from Microsoft, and they were calling it two-factor authentication because one factor is your face and the other factor is your computer.
What?
Well, and Rod and Rob were like, no, that's not two-factor. That's called one factor.
Factor your face.
So there must be something else that we didn't understand about it, but...
No, that's just cheating. That's what that is.
Well, there must be another... Maybe there's another piece to it, though, is what I'm saying.
Well, okay, your face won't unlock someone else's computer, so you do need your face and your computer. But
it still didn't count. Maybe 1.2 factor...
Yeah, actually, I jumped in my show notes backwards. So yeah, so the Windows Hello story is actually a separate story. That's also in there. And Google are also doing some tweaks to their app submission process if you're interested. And as I say, the whole point of suggested reading is that it's up to you guys to read it if you want. Okay, so with all that security behind us, how's about we do some terminal taming?
Yay!
Okay, so before we get into new stuff, just a little update from the fantastic listeners. We have listeners who tell us cool things.
Hot dogs.
So last time we talked about how you use SSH to run a command or to get a remote terminal. And so we said that, you know, SSH, user at machine, and then give a command or just hit enter, and then you get a command prompt and you'll be on the remote computer. And we explained how there's this whole host keys for security, and if your computer changes IP address and stuff, you may have to delete one of the host keys. And I said, go into the file by manually with your favorite text editor and delete the entry. Which works, definitely a valid way to do it. But one of our listeners tweeted me with a much, much easier solution. There's a command for that. So it's actually a command we're going to meet again today in a different context. So ssh-keygen is a command we're going to use today to make keys, but you can also use it to make keys go away. And so if you say ssh-keygen space minus capital OR and then the name of the computer you're trying to SSH to that it's whining about, it will delete the key for you. It will figure out the right line and the right file, do it all for you, and then you're golden.
Okay, cool. Who was the alert reader?
So that would be Adrian Luff, at Adrian Luff on Twitter.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you, Adrian.
Yes, so that was cool. So now we can get into... more taming terminal taming. All so right. Part 30 of N, and I've now discovered SSH is going to be four parts.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Right. Well, no, I wasn't sure how many I was going to break into, but it's clear now. So what we did last time was the basics. Running a command remotely or getting a remote shell, which is useful and very good. Today, we're going to do exactly the same thing, but in a more secure way. Then the next week, we're going to, instead of sending commands through SSH, we're going to send files through SSH. So in other words, what? Security transfer files, which is a very important thing to be able to do. And then the week after, we're going to securely send anything. So we're going to use, it's called SSH tunneling. And it's a way of getting the same security as a VPN with more effort, but without a VPN. Right?
Okay.
So it may be a more appropriate solution in some cases. It's very cool. So that's how it's going to break out. So today we're going to do, we're going to connect over SSH, but instead of using a password, we're going to use keys. And we're going to do something very unusual in the IT world. We're going to make something that is more secure and more convenient.
That's not possible. You get one or the other, Bart.
Usually that's true. Today, we're going to break the space-time continuum or something. We're actually going to manage to do both because SSH rocks.
Okay.
So what we're going to do is SSH key authentication. And this whole thing revolves around public-private key cryptography. And so I thought we might start with just a little primer on that. I know we've talked about it before when we've talked about the PKI, but I just thought we might do a little refresher first.
Yeah, I think that's in order. I don't know about the rest of them, but I can, as I was telling Bart, I didn't know how to use my Starbucks card this morning is how dopey I am. So a little refresher would help.
So in normal encryption, we have some sort of encryption algorithm that takes some plain text, runs it based on some sort of key, and mushes out some encrypted text. Mm-hmm. And with symmetric encryption, you have one key. So you take your data, you encrypt it with this key, you get out garbage, you take the same key, and you get back what you started with. So it's symmetric, right? One password, one key. Same key makes it be encrypted, and then the same key makes it be decrypted. That's symmetric encryption. If I sent you a zip file with a password on it, that's symmetric encryption. I use that password to encrypt, use the same password to decrypt. And that's what we use most of the time. There is also something called asymmetric encryption, where you don't have a key, you have a key pair. And whatever you encrypt with key number one can only be decrypted with key number two. And whatever you encrypt with number two can only be decrypted with number one. In other words, either of them can encrypt, but you have to decrypt with its opposite number.
That's actually the clearest explanation I've heard you give of that. Okay. Is that the same as the public-private key encryption?
Okay, that's a superset of public-private key. So public-private key, we then take that key pair, and we arbitrarily say at the point of creation, you here, key number one, you're private. You here, key number two, you're public. That's the only difference, is that we just decide arbitrarily, pick one, I'm going to keep you a secret forever, and I'm going to tell you to the world. And that's all there is to it. So they behave like they are just an asymmetric key pair, and we just decide to label one private and one public. Now, the reason this is important is if I give you my public key, and you want to prove that I am me, you would take some random number, encrypt it with my public key, and then the only person on the planet who could read that number back to you would be me, because I'm the only person with my private key.
Right. Okay.
So that's how we use asymmetric encryption as a form of authentication. Right. You have authenticated me by me being able to decrypt something you encrypted with my public key. And we can use that as the basis for connecting very securely over SSH, which is what we're going to talk about for this whole segment.
Okay.
So SSH supports many different ways of verifying who you are. And we're not going to look at them all. We already saw one last week. So last week when you connected we were some user on our computer. We typed the command SSH to go to some user on some other computer. It was username at computer. So we were specifying two things. And then we were asked for a password. And the password we were asked for wasn't our password on our computer. It was the password for that username on the computer we were going to.
Right.
Yes?
Right.
That's sort of the default way SSH authenticates you. We're going to not do that. We're going to SSH without having to know that remote password. And we're going to use keys for it instead.
What?
Okay. However, it requires the person who owns the computer we're going to, which may be us, in which case we just ask ourselves to do it. But basically, we give our public key to the person whose computer we want to connect to and say, will you grant that key access?
Okay.
And then we can connect without knowing the password. Let's walk through it. So in order to play along at home, you're going to need two computers again, just like we did last time, one to connect to and one to connect from. And just it doesn't matter which way around you pick it, but just make sure you don't change halfway through or it's all going to get very confusing.
Okay.
So the first step to doing public-private key cryptography is to have a public and a private key. So the first thing we're going to do is use the SSH keygen command we just saw a minute ago to generate a key. And that's its more usual function, is to make keys. And the command is very straightforward. SSH minus keygen space minus T space or SA. You hit enter, and then it will ask you for a password. And I'm going to tell you that you are allowed to put in a blank one, but I don't want you to.
Okay.
This password is going to be the password that protects your private key. So if someone steals your private key, it's useless to them unless they also know the password that matches the key. So if we want to do this as securely as possible, we should give that key a password. It can be anything. It doesn't have to be a password you use on the computer. It can be anything you like. In fact, I think it calls it a passphrase to suggest you make a long one. But bear in mind that you have to remember it, because if you forget it, the key pair is useless. Which is a good thing, because if someone steals your key pair, if they don't know it, the key pair is useless.
I'm lost.
Lost, okay.
So I thought the whole key pair was the security. Why do you have to have a password on a security thing? What?
Because otherwise, okay, so a key is just some numbers, right? So it's just a file on your computer. What if someone just takes that file? They can now be you. But if you password protect that file, they can't be you. It's okay. Two-factor auth.
Okay.
Work with me for now, and hopefully it will become clear as we go through.
Okay, because you said, and it's real simple, SSHS, keychain dash, T, RSA.
Okay, so now it's going to ask you for a password.
Okay, I don't know what any of that means. SSH dash keygen space dash T space RSA. I don't know what I just told it to do.
You're asking it to make you an RSA key. RSA is an acronym that sounds for...
generate a key. Okay.
Using the RSA algorithm.
And I talked over you telling... Sorry, we must be having some lag. I talked over you saying what RSA stands for.
I don't remember what the acronym is. It's a form of cryptography that's better than the old one, which is called DSA.
Okay. All right. So it just said enter file in which to save the key.
What? Shouldn't be asking you that. Well, why is it asking you something it didn't ask me?
Generating public/private RSA key pair. Enter file.
Oh, you may have to hit enter to get the default, is it? No. But sorry. Okay, you do have to hit enter to accept the defaults. My apologies. I need
so
to
it says /user/Allison/.ssh/ID_RSA.
Okay. So basically you can accept that default and just hit enter.
Okay, I'm never going to be able to see this file, though, because it's in a .ssh folder.
We have the terminal, Allison. We can do that.
Okay. All right, enter passphrase. Okay.
So anything you like, not nothing, and just remember it.
Okay. All right. Enter it again.
It will now show you a horrible big key signature that's a whole bunch of hexadecimal stuff separated by colons and a pretty picture.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. The pretty picture is a really cool idea that computer scientists had. Imagine I gave you two of those big horrible signatures to check one against the other. It would be very annoying, and it would take you a while to make sure they were exactly the same all the way through.
Okay.
Human beings will spot a difference in the ASCII art instantly.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so its ASCII art looks kind of like a heart, sort of, maybe.
Well, everyone's will be different, right?
Little so that box. Okay.
That picture is your key.
Oh, interesting. And it's called random art.
Picture. It's random art. It's a really cool idea. So you can compare two keys really quickly as a human being. It's a cool feature. Anyway.
Oh, because it wouldn't have one digit different. You're saying it would just look completely different.
Yeah, well, imagine you had those two big, you see the big hexadecimal string that says your key signature is this.
Right.
If one of those was just a little bit different 20 characters in, we'd never notice. But the picture would be different enough that we'd spot it straight away because humans are just
good at
that.
So the picture's a lot different, not a little bit different. The picture
it'd probably just be a little bit different. Like one of the dots might be an at symbol or something, but we humans are very good at that kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Anyway, so that's just a cool thing they do. So we now have two files. One of them is called /.ssh/ID_RSA. That is our private key. And then we have one called /.ssh/ID_RSA.pub, which is our public key. And we can use the cat command to have a look at them. So if you say cat /.ssh/ID_RSA, it will show you your private key.
Hang on, you're going way too fast. Cat what?
Okay.
/.ssh/ID_RSA.
Yes. Okay. And you will see that your key is quite large.
I don't like that. That's annoying. I don't want to look at that.
Okay, but the good thing is, think of how much bigger that is than any password you could ever remember.
Yeah.
Is someone going to brute force that?
No.
No.
Okay.
You should also see at the top it says proc type 4 encrypted because you have a nice encrypted password with triple des.
Okay.
And then the other one is your public key.
It's littler.
It's littler because it can be littler.
Okay.
And that is what you would need to give. And what you should notice is at the very end of it, it says, it'll probably say Allison at the name of your computer.
Where's? Oh, yes, it does.
Okay, which is a little trick it does. That's not part of the key. It's just conveniently added on after the equals equals. And it's there so that when you're looking on a server to see who you've given access, you can very quickly see, oh, that's Bart's key. It's, you know, it's a little convenience.
Okay.
Something else that's worth saying. So both of those keys are in a format you may or may not recognize. They're in something really common called Base 64 encoding.
Oh, you know, I totally noticed that, Bart.
Well, it is common. And what's really cool about Base 64 encoding is that you can stick a new line character into it anywhere without breaking it. So in other words, you could paste that into an email. The email client could completely muck up the line endings and it would still work. So you can safely email this around without it breaking.
Okay.
Which is the advantage of Base 64 encoding. And actually, Base 64 is what's used when you send... If you put a JPEG into an email, it gets broken down into this Base 64 encoding and then sent, because email is actually a purely text medium.
Hmm. Okay.
Anyway, I thought that was cool. So you now have a public and a private key, and you would like to use this to log into your second computer, which is owned by you probably, but imagine it was owned by someone else. So what you now need to do is you need to give that key to the person who runs the other computer you want to connect to, and they just have to put it into a special file, which then tells SSH that the owner of the private key may log in. And that special file is /.ssh/authorized_keys.
Okay.
And if you put that key into that file, can log in. The public.
The public key.
The public key. So imagine you have your computer and you have five servers you're allowed into. You give that same public key to five different people. They all let you in. You connect with the one private key that you never, ever, ever share with anyone ever.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
A little bit.
Okay, well, the private key should just never share the private key. If it doesn't end in .pub, you're not supposed to share it.
Okay. All right.
So we could manually go to that computer, create that file, and copy in that key. And, well, we can do that. We're not going to, because we're going to do it the easy way, but you can. One thing I think is very important to point out is that SSH is an absolute, complete, total, and utter stickler for detail on the permissions on that file. And the reason is, imagine you were trying to let me SSH into your computer, and you accidentally put write access on that authorized keys file. Then any other user sharing your computer could suddenly log into your account because they could just put their key into that file. Right? Because whoever's public key is in that file can now SSH to your computer. So it's really important that file not be writable
by anyone
except for the account.
But we had to write it, so it's writable.
Okay. It's writable by you, the owner of the account. Okay, no, it's okay. The owner of the account can write to it, but no one else on the system can.
Okay, so we want some of that chown stuff all over it with a W on owner, but not on group or world.
Exactly. So what I have in the show notes is a screenshot, or a sort of a terminal capture, not a screenshot, of working permissions on a server I use all the time. And you'll see that it's authorized keys as RW or OR. And the ORs are fine because it's a public key, so it really doesn't matter if anyone else can see it, but it's really important no one can write to it. And what SSH will do if you get the permissions wrong is it will ignore the file. It will pretend the file doesn't exist, which is a safe failsafe, right? This could have been tampered with, therefore I will not trust it.
Okay.
And so one of the most common causes of SSH key login not working for people is that the permissions are wrong on the authorized keys file, and SSH is just ignoring it because it doesn't like it.
So, Bart,
I am suspicious.
I'm still having trouble with the basic idea of what we're doing here. If I have to log into that computer in order to move this file over there, then why do I need to move a file over there that keeps me from having to log in?
Okay, you're going to do the setup once.
Yeah.
And then you're going to log in without a password forevermore.
From this computer to that computer. I can't sit at a different computer and do it.
Well, no. I mean, in work, I have my public key sitting on about 100 computers.
Okay. But you have to put it everywhere, on every computer to which you're going to SSH into another one, you have to have that public key sitting around.
Yes, which you do once. Now, you can manually do it, which is a pain in the backside. but there's an app for that, as they say. There is a command called ssh-copy-id, and its sole function in life is to put those key files in the right place. If you're using Linux, you just get ssh-copy-id for free. For some reason that I cannot fathom, Apple didn't bother the backside putting it into OS X. Don't know why, they just didn't. However, the open source community has their back. So there is a lovely project called SSH Copy ID for OS X, and the link is in the show notes. And basically, you install it by issuing a single command, and it will install itself. So you can copy and paste the command from the show notes or from their website.
Okay. Am I supposed to be doing this live along with you?
Yeah, absolutely. It takes a second.
Okay.
When you do it, it will ask you for
I don't know where it is.
Okay, so if you see down to simplifying the process with ssh-copy-id is the title heading.
Right.
And then the first command in there is starts with the word curl.
Okay.
Curl minus L, blah, blah, blah. So copy and paste that whole big glop.
Okay.
It will ask you for a password. That is your password for sudo, because it's going to install.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You should see it very quickly. Download two files.
Yeah.
You're done.
Okay. All right.
Okay, that's it. You now have SSH.
What did that do again? That gave me the ssh-copy-id
command. But you now have that command installed on your Mac, so you can do copy ID. So the copy ID command copies public keys for you. And so you just say ssh-copy-id user at computer. And then you log in once, it does all the copying, and then your keys are in place.
And it knows where to put them?
It knows where to put them. It knows what permissions to put on the file. It knows how to do it all correctly.
Okay.
So in other words, what I do in work when I have a new server I need to start connecting to is I just do SSH copy ID once, and that's it. My key's in place.
All right. I'm trying to wake up a computer while we're talking. So if you don't hear me for a second, I'm crawling under here to charge the laptop because my Mac Mini appears to have shut itself down while we were on vacation.
Well, maybe you even shut it down because you were going away for so long.
Not sure. By the way, the delay is because I keep coming up from under my desk as you ask me questions. So hang on. No, that meant keep going for the audience. Don't wait for me.
I have nothing to say now until you're back. Or can you still hear me when you're under there? Don't add.
I can still hear you.
Oh, dearie me. Okay. Once
this would
we
be
have
funnier if you could see it, by the way, because I'm going up and down and up and down. All right, I'm about ready to boot up another computer, so now we can go.
Okay, so when you SSH to another computer using SSH, it actually tries to use keys before it asks you for your password. So last week, what it was actually doing was silently failing to use a key and then asking us to enter a password. So once we have the keys in place, we don't have to change anything. We just do SSH as usual.
Oh, okay. Okay,
and it will use the key.
That actually made some sense to me. Not to imply that everything else has been a complete mystery, but I'm catching up.
Well, hopefully, usually with these things, it comes together at the end. That's my hope.
Okay.
So once you have the SSH copy ID done, and then you go SSH to connect to your Mac, you're going to briefly think I've been lying to you all along. Because it's going to ask you for the password that you just created on the private key. And so what I appear to have done is swapped one password for another.
Well, wait a minute. No, it's going to be worse than that because I can't run SSH copy-id and use the password on my public key because my public key isn't over there yet.
Right. So if you're copying the key over for yourself, you have to know the password once to log in and push your key there. If you were doing this, I'll give you some scenarios later where the kind of place this is used.
But so the first time I'm going to have to use the password to the computer.
You are, yes.
And the second,
if you're doing it this way. So the other way you could do it is you could give the other person who is not you the key and get them to install it for you. But in this case, it's us to us. So it's just easier to use copy ID.
So I am going to use SSHS copy-ID to copy it over there, but it's going to ask me my login credentials first.
Your normal login credentials for the user at computer, yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to be able to do it instantly because that machine had its battery die and it's...
Okay, well, to be honest, it doesn't really matter because there's actually very little to see here.
Okay.
So what will happen is that you will go to SSH in, and after you've done the copy ID, it will now ask you for the password to the key instead of the password to your account. So I will have swapped one password for another, and you're going to tell me you promised me convenience. This doesn't seem very convenient.
Yeah.
This is where the clever bit comes in. So depending on whether you're on OS 10 or on Linux, it's a different clever bit, but the end result is the same. We can safely save that password so you don't have to enter it and still have its security. So on OS 10, SSH is actually tied to the OS 10 keychain. So when it pops you up for that password, it won't be asking you in the terminal. It will give you a pop-up window with a checkbox that says save password. And it will securely, encryptly save that in your keychain.
Which keychain?
So in other words,
my computer,
the OS 10 system keychain.
No, which one? Mine, my computer, the one I'm logging into.
Your private key will be saved on your computer. So it's your login keychain on your computer where you're SSHing from.
Okay. I don't really use keychain. Do I have to...
No. It'll all happen automatically. You just click the checkbox and it'll be fine. Okay. And then from that moment forth, every time you SSH, keychain will fill in the password for you entirely invisibly. You won't see anything. And you will log in instantly without a password.
Okay.
So from your point of view, it has now become way more convenient. From a security point of view, you now have a giant big key instead of a password, and that giant big key is protected by the password that's on the key, which is safely stored in your keychain.
This feels convoluted when I know I can push this little button that says connect as, and it saves my password in my keychain. I know I'm doing all this so I can use the terminal, but...
But now you're going to have the same convenience on the terminal. You're going to get a pop-up that says save this password. You're going to go yes, and that'll be the last time you ever see that password. So the end result is the same. It's like when you're connecting with the Finder, you have to save the password once. You're going to save this password once, and that'll be that. Now, if you're on Linux, you don't have an OS 10 keychain, obviously, because you don't have an OS 10. So on Linux, there's an app for that called SSH-Agent. And I'm not going to go into the detail because this is a sort of a Mackie podcast, but if you type SSH-agent tutorial into the Googles, I have checked, they have lots of good answers. Okay. So at this stage, I'm going to convince you this is worth the effort.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm definitely not buying it yet.
Okay. Now, let's condense everything we've done down very quickly into what it actually is once you know how to do it. So you get a new Mac and you decide that you want quick and easy SSH access to your iMac or to Steve's Mac or whatever. So once in the entire life of your Mac, you're going to run SSH keygen minus T RSA. That's going to be done once in the entire life of your Mac. You now have a key pair.
Oh, so if I want to share this with a bunch of different computers, I'm going to put the same private key on all the different computers?
Same public key. Your private key never leaves your computer.
Okay, public key. All right.
Yes, exactly. So in other words, this key generation is done once in the life of the computer. So that's not too difficult. After that, every new computer you want to connect to in the future, you just have to do an SSH copy ID once.
I got to log in. I got to give it my first password and then my second password.
Well, no, because remember, it's the one private key. So the one time in the entire history of the computer you click the little checkbox to save password, it will be saved forever. For every computer you ever want to log into, your private key's password you're going to enter once in your life.
Okay.
And then it's going to be in your OS X keychain. You're never going to think about it again until you buy a new Mac.
Until I change computers. Okay.
Yeah. So then when you want to add, so you want to do your Mac Mini, you now do SSH copy ID, SSH minus copy minus ID once to the Mac. You're going to do it once to Steve's computer. How many computers have you got in the house? 4 or 5 at most?
Yeah.
So you're going to issue that command 4 or 5 times and then once more whenever you buy a new computer.
You know, I know this has nothing to do with what you're talking about, but it drives me nuts is I can't do any of this unless I know the IP address of the computer I'm trying to log into, and I don't know how to find out what that is. So I've done this before where I was trying to log in from travel. I was trying to SSH into my VPN server or something like that, and I didn't know its IP address, so I couldn't do anything anyway.
Well, this is why I would always say on your router, you should set static IPs, and we must check. I have to check on the airport how this works. But you should be able to give names to stuff in your network. Leave that one with me. We'll come back to that in a later time in the terminal.
Okay.
Because there are options.
Because it makes this useless to me. It's useless because I can't remember anything.
In my house, every computer's name is also... So I can just go ssh-bart-imac.localdomain and it just works. So we'll figure out how to make that work for other people in a future episode.
Okay.
Also, you have a web server that you SSH to.
I do.
You can use this. You do. Your Bluehost is SSH.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can authenticate to it with a public key instead of with your password.
Why would I want to SSH into my web server?
Well, you do to send up files. You're doing secure copy or SFTP.
Right. That's not SSH. That's SFTP.
SFTP, the S is SSH, as we're going to discover next week.
Okay. I'm struggling with the problem to be solved here, but I'll try to stay with you.
Okay, so firstly, so for convenience, right? So you're saying this sounds very convoluted, but it sounds convoluted because a lot of the stuff we did today is something you do once in the life of the computer. Once this is done, you just SSH to the computer and it just happens instantly. So if you want to do some sort of backup script in the future, you can now run it at any time of the night because your password isn't needed. You can just reach in, do a backup, and you're finished. You know, it just becomes, it's very convenient to connect without the password. Now, you have more security than you had before you started, but also it's a form of two-factor auth because you need the key and you need the password to get in. Now, where this really comes into its own is if you have one computer that multiple people use. So I was going to give an artificial example, but maybe let's give a less artificial one. So you went away for 3 weeks and you had myself, Guy, and Alistair running your show. And you created a new password for your Bluehost. You share that password with the three of us, and I presume you've now changed it to one the three of us don't know. Yes?
I'm sorry. Which password?
For Bluehost, where we put the files for the show.
Okay. Right. I haven't done anything, Bart. I'm barely spelling my own name
okay,
right now.
Let's go hypothetical.
But yes.
Imagine you're with some sort of sports club. And there's a couple of you have decided to work together on a website for the sports club. And so you have your code sitting on a computer somewhere and you all SSH to it. So you can have a shared password, right? You can say that the password is open123, all three of you have it. And then a week later, some guy leaves the project. Mm-hmm. So you kind of go, he was a bit cranky when he left. I guess we better change the password. It's now open1234 and you all have it. And that works, but it's very, very messy. If you were using public keys for the authentication, you would never have a password. No one would ever know the real password of that computer. You would simply add everyone's key, and when they leave, you take their key out. So when else comes, you put their key in. And so managing who can log into a computer is simply managing the keys. And so if you had done that on your Bluehost server, I would have given you my key, Alistair would have given you his key, Guy would have given you his key, and you would have added our keys in for the 3 weeks you were away and taken them out when you got home. And we would never have had to know your password.
Would that help if you're using a GUI tool like Transmit to do your SFTP?
Well, it would, because Transmit is, yes, it would.
Is a GUI to a...
Is a GUI to the SSH stuff under the hood. Transmit will see keys. You can tell Transmit to use SSH keys. It has support for it. It's one of the little checkboxes.
So does SSH-copy-ID allow me to remove those keys, or do I have to go in and
no, you go in and... You go in and, well, yeah, remember it. Remember I showed you at the end of every key it says who it belongs to?
Yeah. So you go and get rid of it?
Delete that line, yeah.
So it's easier to change my password than it is to go dig those up three times.
Well, you can comment them out and then comment them back in next year.
Yeah, it's easier to change my password than to remove three keys.
Yeah, but then you have to securely tell us your passwords. You had to put it into a little zip file with the password you had to send to us through different means.
Yeah, so that's true. Yeah.
Whereas if it was based on public keys, I could have tweeted it to you. It would have been secure.
Okay. Except it's more than 140 characters.
Okay, I could have emailed it to you and I wouldn't have had to care about the fact that email is terribly insecure. And okay. I mean, it is. I would hate to have to put my password in every time I SSH somewhere. It would drive me absolutely potty.
By the way, also, I did finally go through and do it and it just worked. And I got the screen that you said I should see.
Excellent. I thought you were slightly distracted, which tells me you're doing stuff on the terminal.
Right, that was right when I went, I think that was my clever way of answering your question.
So, I mean, it is easy, right? It sounds complicated, but it is actually easy.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, what we're going to talk about next week is using SSH to transmit files. And one of the protocols you can do over SSH is OrSync. And OrSync is a really efficient backup tool because it synchronizes rather than copying everything. So if only one file changed, only one file gets transmitted. If you have SSH keys, you can have automated backups at 4 o'clock in the morning. They just happen every night.
Mm.
So So imagine being able to reach into your Bluehost server, do a full backup of your website at 4 o'clock in the morning from the Mac Mini.
I actually think that Chronosync uses rsync, right?
Chronosync uses that. Rsync. That is correct.
So I'm doing it, but I don't have to know how to do it.
Okay, but it's good to know. That is the point of taming the terminal.
Right.
It takes the magic away. It reveals all the magic and shows how the trick is done. So next week, we're going to look in detail at two different protocols for sending files over an SSH connection, which is SFTP and rsync.
Oh, that sounds fun. Hey, let me back you up, though, with another question. So okay. I did successfully, because I could look right at the computer and ask it what its IP address is, I was able to SSH in by IP address, and I was able to share the key and copy it over and everything. So now I looked in the sharing preferences, and this Mac does have a name. So it's Kyle-Sheridans-MacBook.local. So now that I've shared my key and it's all connected up and everything, now I exited and I tried it again. I said SSH Allison at Kyle-Sheridans-MacBook.local, and it's saying the authenticity of host blah 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 cannot be established. RSA key fingerprint is giant long hexadecimal code. Are you sure you want to continue?
This is what we did last week. Okay, so just say yes for the first time.
Well,
this is
how
the first
do I know that's the right RSA key fingerprint? It was supposed to show me that pretty picture.
No, that this is an annoying thing. So remember last time a month ago, which is not a good start to any question. We said that that is not your key. That's the computer's key. So the first time you SSH to a new name, SSH takes a copy of it so that in future it knows if it's changed. You've never SSH to Kyle dash whatever you said before. So it's now saving it into your known hosts file. Now, this has nothing to do with the keys you just made. This is just, I have never seen Kyle's computer before. Do you want me to save Kyle's computer?
But it has seen Kyle's computer. I just connected to it.
No,
it
doesn't know that that IP address and that name are the same thing, right? From its point of view, you typed a different set of characters after the at symbol. So it's going to save it. Once you do it once, that's it. It'll be done.
So why just did like I need to do the other thing then? If I could have just done this, I didn't have to do any of that other crap hole.
This is saving the identity of the name. This has nothing to do with logging in.
Well, it knows it's that IP address because it says the authenticity of host Kyle-Sheridan-MacBook.local parentheses 10.0.1.2, which is what I just SSH'd into.
Yeah. From SSH's point of view, if you go in by a different name, it considers it a different computer, because what if that name was supposed to be going to a different IP? Last week's show notes will say a month ago show notes will say why.
Yeah,
just me and hit yes, and then we can talk about it more offline.
Okay, but I don't understand why I wouldn't just do this.
Okay, but this isn't going to let you. If you hadn't done the keys, this would not have let you log in. This would then have put you up the password prompt.
Well, yes, and it didn't. It closed the connection. That's weird. Try it again.
You may have been too slow.
Nope, I just tried it again, and now it lets me in. So it when I told it yes, it said no, and when I didn't tell it, it said yes. Yeah, I'm keeping up. It's great, Bart. Jeez. Okay, I mean, it's working now.
Okay, and you're not entering your password. You're getting straight in and straight out?
Right.
Which means that you could, at 4 o'clock in the morning, copy over lots of files every day?
Yeah.
So we are set to learn how to do files.
Okay.
Okay, it's
I understand it. It does seem like an awful lot of work for the value.
It does, until you do it a few times.
Yeah, I think what we need to get to at some point is to where I see the value of what I can do, because I could have just clicked that button that said connect on my Mac, that nice little GUI button, and I can drag a file over. So this seems way harder than typing in the password of that computer.
Okay, but you can't run arbitrary terminal commands over Finder.
Yeah, you're going to have to show me what I want to do to get me to buy in.
Okay, well, to be honest, I mean, connecting from Mac to Mac is a bit arbitrary. Usually you'll be connecting out to, like, your web server or something useful that you're trying to achieve something on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. But, I mean, I have seen a lot of the taming the terminal shows me things that I is better and easier and more useful in the terminal than it is in the GUI. And this is a case of where it was significantly harder. That's all.
Okay. In that case, I can give you a sneak peek of something that's coming at a time I don't know what number it will be out of N, but it is going to happen before we finish this series. Is, you know, the way we did a network troubleshooting episode?
Yeah.
Well, there's another troubleshooting episode coming where what to do when the GUI on your Mac freezes. And step one is get another Mac and SSH into that Mac and then try to recover the situation from the terminal.
Yeah. Yeah, I want that one because that has happened.
It happens a lot. And if you have the SSH keys and everything in place, that's way easier.
Okay, good. Oh, by the way, on my great India adventure, we were actually invited on the trip by a guy named Raleigh. And Raleigh on the trip said that he became a Patreon of yours over on your Let's Dash Talk series because of the networking stuff that you'd done on podfeet.com on the podcast. Yeah. So say hi, Raleigh.
Hi, Raleigh. And thank you. And it's also you suggested people do that. So thank you.
Yeah, there you go. So I thought you'd like that because he really, really liked the network trouble shooting series. He even remembered which of N it was. I think he said 18 or something like that. So yeah, he was really excited. So.
Okay, good.
Very cool. All right. Well, I think I'm caught up. I do understand what it's doing now, and you're right. Just sticking with it was the trick to keep listening. Stop whining. Well, I'll always whine, but you know.
I always wish I could just jump to the end and just teleport knowledge into people's brains.
All right. Well, I think we're good until next time, right?
Indeed. So until then, happy computing.
Well, I'm glad Bart stuck with me because I finally figured out what he was talking about. But yeah, jet lag is killing me today. I will be back on my 100% game by next week, I promise. But that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor to help pay the bills, the makers of Clarify over at clarify-it.com. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter @podfeet. Do check out the NoSillaCast Google Plus community. A lot of people kept working on stuff together while I was gone. And of course, I always post my blog posts in there so you know when new stuff is coming out during the week. This week, it kind of all came out on Sunday, but close enough. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, we will be back on Sunday nights. Head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.